we inform.
Religious freedom is about people of faith being able to live out their faith, live out their convictions, no matter where they are.
We equip.
Sacred honor is the courage to speak truth, to live out your free speech.
We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance, character, and character, hope.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you with us here on the program. Walker Wildman and Rick Green, we are your host each week. And this is our Wednesday live edition of the program. We'll have Philip Horagy with us in the last segment on the program talking about the Supreme Court and a subject that at times has been a very popular subject to talk about, but is not being talked about much right now, maybe just because it's not a top priority in the near term, but long term, the courts play a strategic role in the future of our nation. So we'll talk with Philip Horagy about that in the last segment and the work that we are doing, Philip and I and others, to ensure that future Supreme Court justices fall into the mold of Justice Thomas and Alito and help serve as a firewall between an out-of-control Washington and the rest of the country. So we'll talk with Philip in the last segment on that subject. Very fascinating discussion and something we've been working on for the last 12 to 18 months as we look forward to a non-Biden administration taking the helm at some point, you know, whether it be January of next year or 4 years after that, who knows what the future holds. Only the Lord does. But our movement, the evangelical movement, needs to be ready to go. And this play-in from behind is a loser. The play-in from behind, you know, being outmaneuvered by the Marxist, it is a loser. And our movement as a whole is just fed up with being underprepared for the battle that is in front of us. So we're working to better that. And I'm speaking to myself too on this. So we'll talk with Philip in the last segment on that. The scripture for today is in Psalm 105. That's where we are this week. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, call upon his name, make known his deeds among the peoples, sing to him, sing praises to him, tell of all of his wondrous works, glory in his holy name. Let the hearts of those who seek the Lord rejoice. Seek the Lord and his strength. Seek his presence continually. That's verse 4 there. So, praise the Lord and seek his presence continually. That's the wisdom that we pull from Psalm 105, verses 1 through 4. What I want to hit on this first segment, at least the first segment, maybe a little bit of the next segment as well, but this ship fiasco in Baltimore is of course was unexpected and is a statistical anomaly. And I've got some clips from Laura Logan, well respected investigative journalist on this very subject. She has sources that we're going to listen to, but this is being dismissed way too quickly, and this is the frustration with and this isn't just a media thing. This gets into government, but certain things that are dismissed out of hand immediately, and other crises were never really given a full answer. And it's bizarre how this works. And at times, there's not a conspiracy behind every corner. Some people think there is. And this case with this container ship very well could simply be that there was a catastrophic malfunction of some kind of system within the ship and it wrecked. That very well could be the case. But we don't know that. And the problem is when everybody, and when I say everybody, I mean a lot of people, within hours of this ship striking a critical concrete pier holding up the entirety of the bridge, or 50%, within hours, the majority of people discussing this with respect have dismissed it as a system malfunction, and let's move on. We know what happened. There was a power failure. The pilot couldn't steer the ship, and then it hit the bridge, and then that's it. That's all there is to the story, they say. And that very well may be the case, but the problem I have is the immediate dismissal of any other probability, any other likelihood is dismissed. And the FBI comes out at the press conference and says, oh yeah, absolutely, this wasn't terrorism. I mean, there's no indication that this was terrorism. And I'm wondering, like, has the FBI even been on the boat yet? Because the sun just came up. This literally just happened. And you're already at a press conference saying, no, this was not terrorism. I mean, we know this is not terrorism. We're certain this was not terrorism. Okay, well, that was quick. I mean, last time I checked, it takes you guys like years to do investigations. I mean, we don't even know who leaked the Supreme Court draft on the Dobbs case. But we know this wasn't terrorism. And we know there was no criminality involved. It was just an accident, guys. We don't know who killed Epstein. So Jeffrey Epstein reportedly had blackmail material on high-profile politicians and businessmen, and he just happened to commit, in air quotes, suicide in a New York City detainment facility, and all the cameras on the wing that Epstein was in just happened to not be working on that day. And the guards that were supposed to be watching him just happened to be asleep during the time that he committed suicide. But it was a coincidence. All of that I just said, complete coincidence. Jeffrey Epstein committed suicide. Nothing to see here, folks. What? This stuff. Things do happen. Coincidences do occur. But not at this rate, folks. Not at this rate. And so the backdrop of this entire discussion about what on earth went wrong with the ship that just happened to float at 8 knots into the one of two piers that held the entire bridge up, and it struck it in such a manner that the whole thing came crumbling down. And we want to dismiss it within 5 minutes of discussion as an accident. And we're not going to look further into it. It was an accident, system malfunction, move on. The NTSB, they didn't get on the ship until like nearly 24 hours after the, actually more than 24 hours. They didn't get on the ship until this morning. NTSB did not get on the ship to retrieve the black box until over 24 hours after the incident. And once again, this is within miles of what is called the, Bobby can help me with this. This is the Washington area. They call it the national, there's a national security term that is used for the region. To describe basically the Washington, D.C. region from a military standpoint.
Yeah, it's aside from the no-fly zone and all the other critical infrastructure that goes along with that, yeah.
Yeah, so what I'm getting at is, and there's a term for
everything's
it.
Expedient.
Yeah, there's a term for it, and I'll find it later. But this region of the U.S., the D.C. region is heavily militarized, law enforcement everywhere, you know, multiple military sites, Navy sites, the list goes on, right? The Capitol, everything. And so you got that term, Bobby?
Got it. It's the Washington, D.C. special flight rules area from the aviation standpoint, and maritime is the same restrictions.
Yeah. So this area is within minutes, if not an hour or two, from every possible resource you would need to conduct an immediate and thorough investigation into the cause of this wreck. That's what I'm getting at. And the fact that it took NTSB 24 plus hours to get on the boat is like, what are we doing here? Is this like a McDonald's drive-through? 24 hours? You guys got your headquarters like within an hour of this place. And so I'm going to play a clip here. We're going to open this up. We'll finish it in the second segment. But what exactly happened here, we don't know yet. But we shouldn't close the book on it. That's my point. Let's listen to Laura Logan, investigative journalist, open up this discussion of what on earth happened.
Well, I have a better question for you, Steve. Why are you coming to the mic telling the country that it's not terrorism when your own intelligence agencies are telling you it is? And I know they are, because I didn't make this up. These are not my words, right? I'm talking to people who are on the inside, some who are on active duty, some who are retired, and everyone, literally, from critical infrastructure in Department of Homeland Security to the intelligence agencies, they know there's no other, it's there. This is a cyber attack on a critical infrastructure corridor for the United States. This is, you know, for those people who think this is just a river, this is in Baltimore, what does this matter? You don't know anything about what you're talking about. This, the I-94 corridor on the eastern seaboard is literally what connects the north and south. And when I talk about hazardous materials, right? This is a brilliant, well-planned strategic attack on one of the most important supply chains in the United States of America. The only other one is in the western side in California. That's the only one that's busier. And what you have done is you now have shut it down. And when I talk about hazardous materials, what are we talking about here? This is refined fuels, right? This is propane gas. This is diesel. This is fuel. This is flammable materials. This is oversized loads, nitrogen, chemicals. Everything that you need for your economy to move has literally just been shut down for 4 to 5 years.
Well, there you have it. That's just the intro. I've got two other clips for the next segment. But what Laura Logan is pointing out here is the impact. And this is what we can't miss out on. And this is what makes this incident worthy of very thorough investigation, very thorough reporting by journalists, by the way. They should be all over this. But what makes me want to listen to Laura Logan and keep the book open on what caused this ship to hit this bridge is when I go to a sheet of paper and I start totaling out, and I'm not good at math, but I start totaling out the statistical probability of this occurring ever. What is the statistical probability of this ship at this location losing its engine or whatever system failed at the exact time, and once again, the exact location, and in such a manner that it struck this pier at just the right speed to bring the entire thing down? And if you run the math on that, which I'm not smart enough to do, this is what I would call an extremely unlikely scenario to occur with all of these circumstances. Very, very unlikely. And it happened. We'll be back in a few.
At the Core podcast are available at AFR.net. Now, back to At the Core on American Family Radio.
Welcome back to the Core, second segment underway. It's Worship Wednesday, and the song there is He Worthy? And the answer is He is. That was by Shane and Shane. Jumping back into our subject while we have this segment remaining is what we're talking about is the cargo ship that struck the Baltimore bridge, and which brought it down, major interstate corridor and bridge used for a litany of purposes, heavy cargo bridge, and one of the main ones in the region that connects that entire East Coast interstate system. But the National Capital Region is the term I was looking for. The National Capital Region, it includes Virginia, D.C., and Maryland, a lot of military a lot of military and federal agencies in that region. But that's the term I'm talking about. So the access to resources is readily available was the point I was getting at. And that it should not take the NTSB 24 hours to get to the ship, get on the ship, and retrieve the black box. I also noticed that the crew was remaining on the ship, according to the Washington Post. The crew was remaining on the ship, which I find maybe normal practice, but during an investigative period, I find quite interesting that you would allow non-law enforcement individuals to remain at a crime, at what could be a crime scene, for an indefinite period of time. But nonetheless, back to the main subject at hand here, and that the subject we're talking about is: was this just an accident? A malfunction in the ship's system, or is there something larger at play here? And if so, are there the proper systems in place to pick up on this? For example, to Laura Logan's point, if this ship was attacked via a cyber attack and was basically hijacked remotely to drive it into this pier, into this bridge, are there any records on the ship that would pick up on a breach like that? Are there any IT systems that would log a remote breach into their their shipping system that would veer it off course and drive it into this to this pier. And once again, when you start running the math on all of this adding up, once again, coincidences and crazy events happen without any plausible explanation. But when you start doing the math on this, this is just way out there. The likelihood that this occurs in the manner it occurred, at the location it occurred, all of these things coming together, very, very unlikely. But once again, could happen, but very, very unlikely. And we really don't know what happened. Even investigators will caveat their statements with, we don't know what happened. So they're still investigating this, and more will come out. As far as the amount of cargo, and then we're going to get back to these Laura Logan clips. As far as the amount of cargo, this port, just the port, just the cargo port, that's not considering everything else in that harbor, in that river area. Just the port, the cargo port, does $100 million a day in cargo. $100 million, not a week, not a month, per day in this area. According to Fox Business, let's see. This port is one of the top ports in the country, especially for certain kinds of cargo, especially vehicles. Okay, the Port of Baltimore handles more auto cargo than any other U.S. port, with 750,000 vehicles flowing through the port in 2022 alone. Ford and GM each announced that they are working to reroute auto shipments that were scheduled to go to Baltimore and said that the impact would be minimal. Not sure if I believe that, calling it a minimal disruption. The port also serves as a hub for other goods such as coal, as it was the second busiest port for coal exports in 2023. It is also the largest port by volume for farm and construction machinery, as well as sugar and salt. Its indefinite closure could create bottlenecks in the supply chain, resulting in delays, higher costs for certain goods on the eastern seaboard. So broad impact here, broad impact for this port going down via the bridge being buried in the river. And even the Department of Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg said at a press conference minutes ago, he isn't sure how long it's going to take to get the bridge out of the water. Which is something I thought they would be able to answer. At least, and the reporter even said, look, give me a ballpark. Weeks, months, years. How long is it going to take to get this debris out of the river? He said, I can't tell you. I just can't tell you. So now, how long to rebuild? That is an open-ended question. Some people suspect 4 to 5 years. I think it could be done much quicker than that. That, too, is outstanding. Let's listen to this second installment of Laura Logan on Steve Bannon's show talking about the probability of this being a cyber attack. Clip 3.
100%, yes. They are saying that this is a cyber attack. You didn't have a terrorist group board the ship and commandeer it and take it over. You had somebody hack into the systems on board the ship, the GPS system, and reroute that ship. They did it in the middle of the night because they didn't want the crew to be awake. They didn't want everybody to be on full high alert. They wanted everybody to be asleep and you trying to wake people up and rouse people. Because when I spoke to one individual who has, let's just say he worked in Baltimore for many, many years and was there when that bridge was opened. He knew when he looked at the security camera video of the harbor, the long version, the 7 minutes, he knew from the start of that video when he looked at that ship that it was not in the channel. You need to be in the channel to make that turn, to have any chance of making that turn. So now you're traveling. That is a river that flows pretty quickly, Steve, even under normal circumstances, right? And at a certain point, you're committed. That ship is heavy, the load is heavy, the water flowing at a certain speed, you've got very little room to maneuver. So at a certain point, there was absolutely nothing that they could do to stop that ship from the course that it was on because they were not in control of it. And they had all of these other factors coming into play. So when terrorism and counterterrorism experts look at this, when people who know critical infrastructure, there's a number of different people that I've spoken to, cyber people, when they look at it, they know exactly what they're looking at. And so it's extraordinary that anybody could come out now when they haven't had time to do an investigation, when they, I know for a fact that they're getting people inside their agencies that are telling them what they're telling me, and they're making public statements that completely contradict what anybody who knows this terrain, who knows it, and I don't just mean the physical terrain, I mean the cyber terrain and the terrorism terrain and the, you know, and the critical infrastructure terrain and all of that.
Well, there you have it. That's the second installment of Laura Logan. Do you see why she is sounding credible here? Not only does she have a long track record of being a very well-respected investigative journalist, but she has sources. And of course, she's not revealing the sources, but she's revealing what the sources have said. And uncovering, if this were a cyber attack, uncovering that, folks, would take time. And that's assuming that there is evidence, remaining evidence, lingering evidence that would show a breach of the ship's GPS system. But there are critical questions that are not being answered because they're not looking at them, at least that we're aware of. And that is, are these ships set up in a manner where if there were a cyber breach, that their records, their logs would pick up on it? Because it's very well possible that these ships, we already know, there are reports that this is an older ship that has been in commission for a long time. But many of these ships are outdated. Their systems are outdated. They're just skimping along, making money, shipping goods, and they're not really concerned about upgrading their system to the latest and the greatest. And so do they even have the capability to defend against a cyber attack, to log a cyber attack, to be able to identify it and pinpoint it? I don't know. We don't know that because we haven't been told that or not. The third clip I want to play here, this is the last installment of Laura Logan. This is her wrap-up on why we should not dismiss this probability. Clip 4.
I've talked to people whose job after 9/11 was to identify, if you were Al-Qaeda and you wanted to capitalize on that attack, how would you do it? They were the people that came up with the term death by a thousand cuts. And what you're looking at now is exactly what they feared terrorist groups would do to really exploit the advantage that they had after 9/11, because you are bringing the United States to its knees step by step from within.
Well, there you have it. That's the wrap up there. And let's see. Here's an analogy or a comparison I have that might help bring this into frame. And this is not a perfect comparison, but it's pretty close. The probability of this ship striking the pier in the manner that it did. Once again, this is not not a near miss, not a ship, you know, floated into the pier and damaged the structure, but it didn't come tumbling down and wow, aren't we glad? So this wasn't a near miss. This was a head-on strike. Folks, this would be like, not a perfect analogy, but pretty close. This would be like, Lord forbid, a plane hitting a major tower in New York City. Maybe not the Twin Towers, although the Twin Towers aren't there anymore. Maybe not Freedom Tower. You know, maybe not the Empire State Building. Once again, Lord forbid, and I mean that seriously. But it would be like a airliner hitting a high rise in New York City, and within hours, the FBI says there's no indication of this being a terroristic incident. No indication. One of the engines failed. When you start doing the math, that's where you land on this. No pun intended. That's where you land on this. And so we already know we have foreign enemies attempting this. I mean, when you go over to the Department of Homeland Security website, they put out a press release in February of 2024, February 21, that's when this is dated, 2024. Listen to this. Fact sheet. This is on the Department of Homeland Security website. DHS moves to improve supply chain resilience and cybersecurity within our maritime critical infrastructure. Today, the Department of Homeland Security and the Biden administration are taking new actions to protect American maritime critical infrastructure, bolster port cybersecurity, and improve supply chain resilience. As a maritime nation, America's prosperity remains inextricably linked to the integrated and extensive network of ports, terminals, vessels, waterways, and landside connections constituting the U.S. maritime transportation system. This extensive system supports $5.4 trillion worth of economic activity each year and contributes to the employment of more than 31 million Americans. And then they go on talking about all that they're doing to improve the cyber dynamics of these ships. One of the bullet points that they put in here, according to this executive order by the Biden administration, is requiring vessels and facilities to mitigate unsatisfactory cyber conditions that may endanger the safety of a vessel, facility, or harbor. Requiring the reporting of any actual or threatened cyber incidents involving the endangering any vessel, harbor, port, waterfront facility to the U.S. Coast Guard. So this is not beyond the realm of possibility, is the point I'm making today. And that as the media, we should not close the book on something so soon, considering the whole of everything that I've mentioned. We'll be back in a few.
This is At the Core on American Family Radio with your host, Walker Wildman.
Welcome back to The Core here on American Family Radio. Glad to have you with us here on the last segment of The Core, hosted each week by myself and Rick Green. And hopefully we will get firm answers in the long run on the investigation into the cargo ship wreck and the downing of the bridge. But after I watched Laura Logan and read some of the reporting and some of the experts weighing in on this, I thought it important to bring before you and important to leave the topic open because of the implications. Should it come out that that was a cyber attack, that has major, major and broad implications for our nation and for our leaders. So it's important not to close the book on that probability, especially, you know, 48 hours after an incident or less. I want to transition to our next topic. I told you we were going to have him on. We have on Philip Horagy with us. Philip is our director of our Center for Judicial Renewal. He's also a senior counsel at AFA Action, and he's been working on researching federal judicial nominees, specifically Supreme Court nominees for future administrations. Philip, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Walker. Great to be with you.
Well, Philip, I usually pronounce your last name Juregi, but I heard you pronounce it last week when we were together, and you said Horagy. So did I have that right?
Well, you caught me, Walker. When I'm around, because it's a name from northern Spain, a lot of times here in the U.S. we would say Juregi, but if I'm around people that might be Spanish speaking, I say Horagy, because it would be like ordering a quesadilla in a Mexican food restaurant.
Got it. Well, I kind of blended the two, so I'm leaning both directions. So we'll see where we land.
Hey, we can adjust from time to time.
Yeah, we'll change it up, right? Hey, Philip, this project that we've been working on together, researching future Supreme Court picks. People listening may go, "Well, Philip, there's not a vacancy on the Supreme Court," and they would be correct today. But tell folks why we're doing this now.
Sure. Well, Walker, we kind of, you know, take back the clock about 50 years and you look at Republican presidents and the type of justices that they put on the court. I think if you were looking at it honestly, you'd have to say from a constitutionalist and conservative standpoint, we've gotten it right about half the time, maybe not even that good. The left seems to get it right all the time from their values perspective. But when it comes to finding faithful constitutionalist judges, we're at about 50%. And that's not good enough, especially when you consider what we may be looking at in the next presidential administration with one or two retirements, perhaps. Those might be our most faithful and best justices. And so we can't miss one of those. We can't get 50% on these next vacancies. And so the time to do that work, Walker, is now. It's not when there's a vacancy, and it's not even when the next president comes into office, because as we saw last week, the discussions are already starting to occur about who those prospects ought to be. So, as you know, we've been working on this now for over 2 years, spending a lot of time and resources and energy to do this important work.
Philip, one thing that I want you to mention that, may not be at the front of everyone's mind, but it is definitely newsworthy and noteworthy. It is the number of evangelical Christians that have been nominated to the federal judiciary, or more specifically, let's just focus on the Supreme Court. Sure. And once again, this is not a knock on Catholics or a knock on Jews and any kind of insinuation that they're not qualified to be on the judiciary. But for the Supreme Court, talk about the lack of representation, unfortunately, that evangelical Christians have had on the court.
It's been horrible. What is interesting, Walker, is that Biden, his nomination to the court, Ketanji Brown Jackson, one could qualify her as an evangelical Christian as of 10 to 12 years ago. I don't know where she stands now, given some of the statements that she's made, but she definitely did attend a strong evangelical church.
Wow.
10 or 12 years ago. But then we look at Republican presidents and conservative evangelicals. There haven't been any in our lifetimes. You'd have to go back a long time to find any. And that starts to be concerning, because it starts to appear that there's a bias against evangelicals, because that doesn't just happen, right, Walker?
Sure.
I mean, when you're talking about one or two, maybe three, that's one thing. But when you're talking about 8, 10, 12 nominations, and they're all going against evangelical Christians in terms of getting the nomination, that's a concern.
Yeah. We are going to get to the green list, folks. So if you want to know, well, who do you guys recommend for the Supreme Court? We're going to tell you before the end of the segment. But Philip, one more thing I want to hit on, I want you to touch on before we jump to the green list, is some of the concerns and issues we've had with the three Trump-appointed justices. I think we need to address that. Otherwise, some people may think, well, the three Trump appointed are excellent, and we should just keep appointing people like them. But there's a caveat to that. Please explain.
Sure, there is. President Trump's first nominee to the court, of course, replaced Justice Scalia, who passed away during the presidential campaign. And the nominee for that position was Neil Gorsuch. There were some concerns about him and the church that he attended that was pro-LGBT. We were given some assurances and information, whether we believed it or not was tough to say, but hoping it was true that he would not compromise on important constitutionalist issues. Well, I think it was in June, when he authored the opinion Bostock, which expanded LGBT so-called protections in the workplace to homosexuals and transgender folks, such that literally you had a funeral home up in Michigan where a man worked there and greeted grieving families. And he just said to his employer, he said, I'm going to go on vacation. And when I come back, I'd like for you to refer to me as a woman, and I'm going to be dressing up like a woman in the workplace. Well, you know, if you're a Christian and you own a funeral home and you're greeting a grieving family of a teenager, you don't want to try to be accommodating somebody's insanity like that. And yet, that's the opinion that Justice Gorsuch wrote. This was a President Trump nominee. Now, I don't think President Trump liked that. I don't think that's what he wanted, which means we've got to do better research on the front end to ensure that we get the best nominees. And again, Walker, that doesn't just come by drifting downriver and being part of the flow. You have to do hard work, and then you have to be willing to stand up for the right nominees and even oppose some that are questionable.
Yeah, that's right. The Washington Times recently came out with a report that President Trump and his team are considering releasing a list of roughly 20 potential nominees for the Supreme Court during the campaign heading into 2024 election. This is something the president has done in the past on multiple occasions. It's proved very successful to him. But Philip, let's talk about our green list, because we need to get these names out there to ensure that their names are recognizable in the public and in the broader sure. movement.
Sure. Yeah, the names that we've put on a green list, Walker, and let me back up and say we have researched 25 different prospects, and I think the president coming up with a list of 20 is probably not a good idea, because we've spent thousands of hours on this and we can't find 20. So they're not out there. So I think the list of 20 is probably a bad idea. Having a list is a good idea, and we have six that we've put on a green list. You want me to give those names, Walker?
Absolutely. Let's go through them sure. maybe two or three at a time.
Sure, sure. So two that are both on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit are Kyle Duncan and James Ho. Both have a great record. And Walker, we're looking for not just a great judicial philosophy, but also a worldview that's consistent with biblical values and our Constitution. But then third, is there evidence of courage in their record? Because it's one thing to think the right thing or give a good speech when everyone's applauding you, but are you going to stick with it in the tough times when you're being persecuted or there are threats to cancel? So the courage is somewhat difficult to define that, or difficult to determine whether they have the courage, but that's something we look at and spend a lot of time on.
Absolutely. So you may have just mentioned this, but Judge James Ho on the Fifth Circuit, Philip, when you and I talk to people in our movement and members of our coalition, Judge James Ho from the Fifth Circuit, a lot of people like him on the Fifth Circuit, and he's had some excellent rulings. He's on our green list. What about Judge Kyle Duncan? Tell us a little bit about Judge sure. Kyle Duncan.
Yeah, Kyle Duncan's on the Fifth Circuit as well. He has a great record. Again, a lot of courage, like Judge Ho. We've seen that in opinions that he's written where he's refused to cave to the pronoun Nazis, and he's using pronouns that are consistent with biology rather than philosophy, which is excellent. A lot of other great opinions, pro-life opinions, great opinions opposing some of the COVID lockdowns and the COVID insanity that we dealt with. So Kyle Duncan's a great one as well. And then also Lawrence Van Dyke, who's on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Pretty tough place to be for a strong constitutionalist, but he's done a great job there. Neat little thing about Lawrence Van Dyke, he not only went to Harvard Law School, but he also went to Bible school, which that kind of evens it out, Walker. You know, if you've gone to Harvard, that's maybe concerning, but if you've gone to Bible school, we like that.
Duly noted. Philip, so we have Judge James Ho, Judge Kyle Duncan, and Judge Lawrence Van Dyke, three current right. sitting federal judges on our green list for the Supreme Court should a vacancy occur. We also have three more green listers. And we took a more unorthodox approach because of all the reasons you mentioned early on in the segment with some of the issues we've had with past nominees. You and right. I both agreed, hey, let's think outside of the box here.
Exactly.
The president can appoint someone to the Supreme Court, even though they may not be a current sitting federal judge. So talk about those other three.
That's great. And Elena Kagan, who's on the U.S. Supreme Court, is evidence of that. She had been a dean at a law school. Now, she did go to work for the Department of Justice for a short period of time, but then she was nominated to the Supreme Court. So constitutionally, they don't have to have been a sitting judge to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, practically, that may matter, right, in terms of qualifications, but there are three others that we've looked at. One is Kristen Wagner. And we tried to sit back, Walker, and not limit ourselves, but to say, who are the people that we would be the most confident in? And here's an attorney who's the president of the largest religious freedom nonprofit litigation group in the nation, Alliance Defending Freedom. And I'm impressed with Kristen for a couple of reasons. She's principled constitutionally. She's also principled biblically in terms of biblical values and biblical truth. But then third, and this is really tough to pull off, to be great at those first two, but then also to go into a public context and to be winsome about it, almost like an evangelist has to be winsome, right? Mm. And I see Kristen that way, the way she's able to hold her ground on principle, but also to appeal to people who disagree with her and for them to start to move in her direction. She's that persuasive in how she conducts herself. Now, it's possible that she would need to be on a circuit court, or it would be wise for her to be on a circuit court for a brief period of time before being considered for the Supreme Court. But in all honesty, I think she's qualified now and would be a great, great name to consider. There are two others also, Walker, that are both deans of law schools presently. One is Morris Tan, who's the dean at Liberty University Law School. He's originally from South Korea, just an incredible man of God, constitutionalist positions on all the social issues that we care about, great judicial philosophy. And then also Mark Martin. Mark Martin is the dean at High Point University, which is a new law school. He was formerly the dean at Regent Law School, and before that was the youngest chief justice on the North Carolina Supreme Court, has a ton of experience and would be a great justice on the Supreme Court as well.
Excellent. So we have 6 green listers, and we're still conducting research. We do have a red list. For those wondering, you got a green list? Do you have a red list? Absolutely. We don't have time to break down the red list, maybe another day, but we do have a red list. All of that is available at afaaction.net/CJR, afaaction.net/CJR, or you can simply go to the AFA Action homepage and click on the Center for Judicial Renewal and find all the breakdown there. Philip, you got 60 seconds left. Why should people care about CJR, our work here, and the Supreme Court?
Sure. Well, you know, for 50 years, the court was legislating from the bench, which they didn't have the authority to do constitutionally, but they're the ones who brought abortion on demand, even though it wasn't in the Constitution. They're the ones that gave us all of these sexual insanity cases that are not required by the Constitution, but the court created it improperly. They not only created bad policy, but they did it illegally, unconstitutionally. And so right now the court is shifting, Walker. We're seeing great progress. They're not yet where we want them to be, but what we can't have is for them to go backwards. And so these nominations that'll be coming up in the next 1 to 3 years, we need to get those right, because those folks are going to be sitting on the Supreme Court for 20, 30 years. They're going to be the ones who are ruling in cases that affect our grandchildren. So it's important that we get this right.
Absolutely. Hey, Philip, thanks so much for coming on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks, Walker.
All right. That's Philip Jeregi. I call him Philip Jeregi, depending on what day it is, and then he has a third way of pronouncing it. But commonly known Philip Jeregi amongst friends and allies in the movement. Philip's doing great work at the Center for Judicial Renewal. AFAaction.net is that URL. You can find out all the information about our project there. And folks, this has never been done before as far as an evangelical Christian movement coming together with our coalition. We have folks like David Barton, Tony Perkins, Michelle Bachman, Gary Bauer. The list goes on of like-minded evangelical Christians on board with this research, with this group, with this movement, and we have formed the green list. All right, so we have names to put forth to the next administration. We'll be back next time. According to a recent study of hundreds of post-abortive women, 60% of them reported that they would have preferred to give birth if they had received more support from others or had more financial security. And that's where Preborn steps in. Preborn is there for women in their darkest hour, deciding between life and death of their precious child. You see, the reality is women are being pressured to make this fatal decision and are being told that their babies are just a clump of cells. Preborn welcomes women with God's love and introduces them to the beautiful life growing inside of them, which doubles their baby's chances at life. When you support Preborn, you not only support women, you empower them. Your donation of $28 will help a woman to make a choice that she won't have to regret for the rest of her life and gives her the ultimate blessing, life. Your love can save a life. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.